President Donald Trump visited the new National Museum of African American History and Culture this morning in Washington, D.C. It opened last fall. He called the museum special and said the tour was a reminder of, quote, why we have to fight bigotry, intolerance, and hatred in all of its very ugly forms. Trump's pick for Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Ben Carson, joined him on the tour. And joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Eric. Good to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. The president today addressed a wave of bomb threats made recently to Jewish community centers across the country. Let's listen.
The anti-Semitic threats targeting our Jewish community and community centers are horrible and are painful and a very sad reminder of the work that still must be done to root out hate and prejudice and evil.
Ron, it's the first time President Trump has directly addressed the issue of anti-Semitism, even though he's been asked about it before. What do you make of this today?
It seems to be something of a do-over, Eric, because on Thursday last week at that news conference that went on 77 minutes, one of the questions that was a particularly rocky exchange came from a Jewish reporter for a Jewish publication asking about this wave of threats and desecrations and other things that have happened at Jewish community centers and temples and so on. And the president apparently misinterpreted the question, possibly couldn't hear it very well, took it very personally, and at one point told the reporter to sit down. So that was badly received, of course, and for obvious reasons. So he wanted to have a chance to come back at this. Of course, his daughter Ivanka has addressed it in the meantime. And there were some incidents last year as well when people asked him questions about people who had backed him, people like David Duke, the former head of the KKK Nazi party in the United States. And Donald Trump at that time seemed to act as though he didn't know anything about it or didn't know who those people were. So this was a do-over, and the president said all the right things and said them with a great deal of feeling today, and folded that into his discussion of the African American Museum.
Ron, the other news out this morning is that the Department of Homeland Security released guidelines that detail major new policies aimed at detaining and deporting more people who are in the country illegally. What's your take on these memos? I mean, this is in line with what he promised on the campaign trail, right?
Yes, very much so. And former General Kelly has sent out these memos to people at Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and all these other agencies that are part of his purview as the new Secretary of Homeland Security, telling them that there's going to be a surge in the deployment of immigration judges and other people, and there are going to be a lot of people available to enforce the law and get tough on the borders. So these are being seen as pretty tough memos and an indication of a new sheriff in town, if you will, although they do not address the issue that so many people are looking at, that of the Dreamers. President Trump did say today that they're still looking at how to deal with the Dreamers. These are the people who were brought to the United States illegally, but by their parents when they themselves were still children.
The president is also expected, Ron, to sign another executive order soon, a revised version of the one he rolled out in late January, banning travel from 7 majority Muslim countries and temporarily halting the resettlement of refugees. That order was blocked in federal court, as we know. And at a recent press conference, the president promised a new version soon, perhaps this week. What are we expecting there?
We do expect to see it this week, and it could be a case of see you in court, as the president responded initially to the appeals court, to maybe something more like let's make a deal. Stepping back, taking a deep breath, looking at what elements of the original executive order could be retained, possibly even toughened, and what elements should be jettisoned. The president struck a somewhat more conciliatory tone this morning at the museum. He said we need people in the country who love the country and not people who want to harm the country. And possibly in redrafting this executive order, the White House might consider dropping the element of surprise that seemed so important in the original executive order, taking some potential problem people by surprise, but also taking by surprise a lot of the law enforcement community, and that resulted in a lot of confusion and chaos.
And Ron, Congress is out of town. They're in recess this week, but the president is scheduled to speak to a joint session next Tuesday. When they're back, what's expected to be on the top of that agenda?
We're going to hear a lot, I think, about repealing and replacing Obamacare, hear about tax reform, hear about infrastructure, hear about elements of the president's program that he has, in some respects, not really been able to get to yet. He has rolled up his sleeves with respect to these executive orders. But there hasn't been a lot of interplay with the key players in Congress and some of the folks that have been getting into place in the departments. The key figure for Obamacare replacement, for example, is Tom Price, a former congressman who is now the Secretary of Health and Human Services. All these folks need to get on the same page to decide what they're replacing Obamacare with.
We'll be watching, as will NPR's Ron Elving. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you, Eric.
Well, a few hundred people protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota will be forced out of their winter camp tomorrow if they don't evacuate. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum ordered the camp cleaned up and evacuated by Wednesday afternoon. Warm weather is melting winter snow, and it threatens to flood the camp, says the governor. The camp sits along the Cannonball River. Madonna Thunderhawk is a member of the Two Kettle Lakota tribe. She's been living at the protest camp since August. She joins us by cell phone. Madonna, welcome.
Thank you.
So the governor told us on Friday that a good portion of the camp was under a few inches of water already and that tons of trash still needed to be picked up. What are the conditions like at the camp now?
You know, it's true. There's water, but it's the lowlands. We knew that, you know. The snow's going to melt. Duh. But anyway, there's no trash. Campsites were under three. We had three major storms over the past few months. So many camps were buried. Under the guise of helping out, a lot of these camps were pushed up with the snow and the mud and that type of thing to make it look like trash. There's no trash. We've taken care of our camp. And if there's any piles of debris, it's camps that were buried that the authorities pushed up into big piles. I just wanted to make that clear because that's where I live. There's no trash.
So you think that the threat of flooding, for example, and the trash is not as severe as the government is saying that it is? That maybe they're using this in order to try to get the protesters to leave?
No, not to get the protesters. There's no protesters down there. We're water protectors. And we're dealing with not just the governor. We're dealing with Morton County. We're dealing with any kind of law enforcement you want to name that's handy. It's their words, you know, trying to make things look as dramatic as possible, you know. But this is how it operates. Nothing new here.
How many people are still there?
Several hundred. Many are moving up on top. My tribal government has a leased land and has an open area for us to come to camp within sight. And it's all treaty land. So it doesn't really matter. It doesn't have to be on the front lines or on the river. You know, it's all treaty land.
We asked the governor on Friday if he'd send the police in to clear the camp tomorrow if people don't leave, and here's what he told us.
If you've got people that are preventing contractors from doing the cleanup work, or if the people that are contracted to do the cleanup feel threatened by, you know, any kind of self-designated security group in the camp, those kinds of confrontations we're going to have to deal with on a one-by-one basis. But ideally, there are no arrests because we're all on the clean water team.
What's your response to that, and do you think there's going to be a conflict with police?
Well, they're the police. They're the ones that are armed. You know, the threat of violence is there because they're the ones with all the weapons. They're all over the place. They're walking all over. They're up at the casino, at the motel, and they're all, you know, heavily armed and everything. Well, this is the age of Trump. Why not? So any protesters that are going to try to stop cleanup, we've been doing, you know, cleanup on our own. They come in armed to the teeth, and that's cleanup? Come on.
So do you think that people are going to be arrested tomorrow?
I don't know. That's up to what the armed forces are going to do. You know, we know what we stand on. We stand on our treaty rights, that whole area, the original treaty boundaries of you know, and to protect the water. That's all. We're water protectors of all ages. You know, what happens is in the governor's pocket.
So what happens next with you and with this movement? Because after the construction on this pipeline is finished, and it's almost finished, do you have any plans to take this movement any further?
You know what? This isn't a movement. This is ongoing. 2 years ago, we fought XL Pipeline, and that's going to surface again because of Trump. And this is an ongoing thing for us as people of this land, of the original people, the First Nations. We're constantly in the battle with energy corporations across this country. This is just one of many. But it just so happened that the world came to see this.
Why do you think that was?
Because guess who got elected? Where are all the hundreds and thousands of young people going to go when they were in shock? The only resistance that was going on from Mother Earth was right here, of course, in Indian country. We're always carrying the burden.
Do you think that this has made a difference more than other causes that you've fought for? Because you've been an activist for Native American causes for most of your life.
We don't look at it that way. I mean, but for the rest of the country, I suppose, you know, that. But with us, I said, it's a progression. This isn't the first, and this isn't going to be the last. And so we're not looking at things, oh, this is the end, and oh, the big, you know, this is just another benchmark for us, you know?
That's Madonna Thunderhawk, who is speaking with us from near the protest camp along the Cannonball River in North Dakota. Madonna Thunderhawk, thank you so much.
Yeah, okay, good. I got to go.
With the Academy Awards this Sunday, it is time for our annual Listen to the Nominees for the Best Original Song Oscar. Joining us is John Burlingame. He writes about film music for Variety and teaches film music history at the University of Southern California. John, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks, Jeremy. Nice to be here.
And do you think it's been a good year for this category?
This is actually the strongest field for songs in years at the Academy Awards. That's why it's particularly exciting to think about these five choices.
Well, let's listen to some of them. And the hottest film, as we know, is probably La La Land with 14 Oscar nominations. It's a musical about the romance between a jazz musician and a would-be actress in Hollywood. It's a favorite for Best Picture. It has two songs nominated for Best Original Song, both of them written by Justin Hurwitz, Benj Pasek, and Justin Paul. And one of them, City of Stars, is performed by Ryan Gosling, who plays the musician. Let's listen.
City of stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much that I can't see. Who knows? Is this the start of something wonderful and new? Or
so I'm just thinking to myself, as many problems as I have with La La Land, the music is pretty good. So let's listen to the other one that's nominated. Gosling's co-star Emma Stone plays the actress in La La Land, and the song that she sings towards the end of the film, Audition, The Fools That Dream, is also up for an Oscar. Here it is.
Here's to the ones who dream foolish as they may seem. Here's to the hearts that ache. Here's to the mess we make.
Now, neither Ryan Gosling nor Emma Stone are trained singers. Do you think that matters?
Actually, I think it helps in this case. Hmm. It's one of the things that I think has charmed audiences about La La Land and about these two characters.
Well, what do you think of these two songs?
Well, it's a really interesting race, and, you know, the conventional wisdom always has been that if two songs are nominated from the same popular film, that the vote may split, and therefore the winner may actually go to one of the other songs in the category. What's interesting, though, is that over the past 30 years, that situation has happened 10 times, and six of those 10 times, the Oscar still went to the movie that had the two songs entered. So that means that City of Stars or Audition still have a strong shot, and that the idea of a vote split isn't necessarily going to happen. What's interesting about City of Stars is that's the song that Lionsgate, the distributor, is pushing really hard. And I suspect it's because it seems to be the song that embodies the movie.
Yeah.
You know, the title is La La Land, this is the City of Stars. But what I find fascinating about the race is that Audition, which is, as you pointed out, the song that Emma Stone sings toward the end of the movie, is in many ways really what the movie is about. It's about dreamers. It's about the dreamers and trying to achieve those dreams when they come to Los Angeles. And I think it's, in many ways, it may be actually a stronger song But then that's not always what has happened at the Academy Awards. I don't think Beauty and the Beast was the best song from Beauty and the Beast, but it won. So here's a movie that has a very strong shot, not only at winning the score, but also at winning the song.
Could these songs have been nominated if they had been sung by somebody else, if the actors had just lip-synced in the movie?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think both songs, in fact, the entire score is pretty strong. And I think there's so many catchy tunes in that score. And these just happen to be, you know, the two that they chose to promote.
All right, well, let's get to one of the other nominees. The rock star Sting is nominated for co-writing The Empty Chair with J. Ralph. The song appears at the end of the documentary Jim, the James Foley story about the American journalist who was kidnapped and killed by ISIS in 2014. Sting performs the song. Let's listen to a little bit.
If I should close my eyes that my soul can't see, and there's a place at the table that you save for me, so many thousand miles o'er land and sea, I hope today that you hear my prayer, and somehow I'll be there.
What do you think about this one?
Well, you know, I'm fascinated by the recent trend of nominating songs from documentaries. Of the 91 songs entered for Best Song at the Oscars this year, 17 of them were actually from documentaries. This is the one that made it to the final five. Sting is a great writer. This is a heartfelt and thoughtful song. It's kind of an elegy for Jim Foley at the end of the movie. It's just Sting and a piano. It's reverent and sort of quietly moving. I think it's a great song, and I'm glad to see it in the batch, even though, as often happens with documentaries, if many people among the 6,600 voting members of the Academy don't see the film, then that will diminish its chances of winning.
So the Academy voters are not forced by law to watch all of the films that happen.
They're supposed to. You know, what's interesting about the whole race in general is that the nominations are chosen by the music branch, which consists of about 290 composers, songwriters, and music editors. But the choices for the final vote, the final tally, is actually from the entire Academy. Huh. So personal taste enters into it. Whether you've seen the film makes a difference. Whether your kids have been, you know, bugging you about voting for this song or that song. All these factors come into play, and it makes it a fun guessing game.
We're speaking with John Burlingame, who writes about film music for Variety, about the nominees for Best Original Song for the Oscars, which are this weekend. And let's get to the next one. There's Disney's Moana, which has the song How Far I'll Go. It is written by Lin-Manuel Miranda and performed by Auli'i Cruvalho, who is the voice of Moana in the film, Moana, the daughter of an island chief who longs to sail the oceans. Let's listen.
Every turn I take, every trail I track, every path I make, every road leads back to the place I know, where I cannot go, where I long to be. See the line where the sky meets the sea, it calls me, and no one knows how far it goes. If the wind in my sail on the sea stays behind me, one day I'll know. If I go, there's just no telling how far I'll go.
Now, as our listeners may know, Lin-Manuel Miranda is the Tony-winning composer of the Broadway smash Hamilton. And if he wins an Oscar for this, he will have an EGOT, an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. How likely are his chances?
Well, I've been debating this in my own mind. Do Oscar voters care about whether someone will become an EGOT? And I think the answer is no. Huh. However, given that, Lin-Manuel Miranda is about as white-hot a personality in the show business community as we have right now. And so I think his name and his accomplishment, you know, are going to be a factor. And of course, it's a huge Disney animated movie, and those are very often winners. I mean, just think back to Frozen a few years ago, and the success of Let It Go. In this case, How Far I'll Go, which I think was a really good choice from the movie, is the movie's I Want song. which is a kind of a Broadway tradition where the character voices his or her desires and often sets the plot into motion.
All right. Well, the last song that is in this category, nominated for Best Original Song, is one that a lot of people have probably heard, at least the single version of it, which is Can't Stop the Feeling from the animated movie Trolls. It is written by pop star Justin Timberlake, Max Martin, and Carl Johan Schuster. And it's performed in Trolls by Timberlake, Anna Kendrick, as well as other cast members. Here it is.
I got this feeling inside my bones. It goes electric, wavy when I turn it on.
And if you want it inside your soul, just open up your heart, let music take control. I got that sunshine in my pocket, got that good soul in my feet. I feel that hot blood in my body when it drops.
Now, the single version released by Justin Timberlake before the film was released was last year's best-selling song. Will the fact that it was so popular help its chance of winning an Oscar?
Yes, I think in no uncertain terms. And don't discount the fact that the video has been viewed 385 million times on YouTube. But look, the movie's fun, the song is catchy, it's sort of upbeat and fun and dancey, and it's, you know, it's the feel-good song of the year. And if Academy voters say to their kids, well, which one would you vote for, this is going to be the hands-down winner.
Yeah, that's true.
And I might add that Justin Timberlake is well-liked in the community. He's, you know, he's not just a songwriter, he's also been an actor in a number of pictures in recent years. So I think you cannot count out Can't Stop the Feeling as a possible winner this year.
That's John Burlingame, who teaches film music history at the University of Southern California and is also a writer for Variety, writes about film music. John, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, Jeremy.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
The Census Bureau is out with some disheartening news today. According to researchers, two-thirds of all Americans are not putting money into an employer retirement account. Now, that's a higher proportion than earlier estimates, and it comes as very few Americans, just 10%, now have traditional pension plans. Here to look at all this is Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. He joins us from New York. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Eric.
So we'd known for a long time that Americans just aren't saving enough for retirement, but now we have this working paper from the Census Bureau, and it shows the problem really is bigger than we thought. Two-thirds of Americans are not contributing to an employer retirement account. Tell us what's behind that statistic.
Well, two things. One, you know, they don't have access to a workplace retirement plan, and it's astounding how few Americans actually do have that access. The other factor is that they do have that option available to them from their employer, but they're just not putting money in it. They, you know, don't have enough cash on hand. They need all the money they can get living to paycheck to paycheck. You know, another stat I'll throw at you is that the average American couple only has put away around $5,000. So clearly these statistics could be very important to policymakers as our population ages.
$5,000, not enough to live on. What percentage of workers actually have access to an employer retirement plan, and how many of them are saving?
Really good question. You know, the AARP estimates that about 55 million full and part-time private sector workers in the U.S. lack access to a retirement plan through their employer. And, you know, it's only 14% of employers that are offering these 401k-style plans. 14%. Hmm. And you know, back to the statistic you began this conversation with, only a third of them, only a third of the of people who have access are taking this opportunity to save money in these tax-deferred retirement accounts.
So people who are making less money, the researchers found out, had a harder time saving, as expected. But a lot of people aren't eligible for these plans. Is that Jason, because of the rise of temp workers, the nature of the new economy, the changes, what?
Yeah, all those factors. I mean, for one thing, you know, you've had to – many companies, you have to work for a certain amount of time before you're eligible for these plans. And if people are hopping from one job to the other, they may not be there long enough to become eligible. You know, so that's the sort of the temp economy. But you also have part-time workers and who've worked less than 1,000 hours in the previous year. Their employers aren't required to offer them 401k plans.
Jason, this is a big issue. I mean, we're talking about a lot of Americans having to postpone retirement. Talk a little about the impact there.
Right. Well, I mean, we know that life expectancy is increasing, and that means savings may have to last a lot longer, and people may discover that they can't afford to live on Social Security. And also, you do have a lot of young people today who are millennials who recognize that there's the possibility that Social Security won't even be available to them many years from now when it's time to retire. But, you know, they're not putting in the money that they should, according to financial experts, into 401k plans. But, I mean, what it comes down to for people who are retiring, you know, take, for example, women 65 and older. They're working more now than they did 20 years ago. Mostly because they can't afford not to be working.
Jason, thanks for joining us and shedding some light on this issue.
Thank you.
Jason Bellini, The Wall Street Journal. Yesterday, Florida's Supreme Court did something of an about-face and ruled that prosecutors can move forward with death penalty cases despite unresolved constitutional issues with the state's death penalty law. Last fall, the court issued two rulings that found Florida's new death penalty law unconstitutional because it requires only 10 jurors rather than a unanimous 12 to sentence someone to death. In one of the two rulings, the court also said that the law could not be applied to pending prosecutions, which effectively put all capital cases in Florida on hold. State lawmakers say they're planning to take up the issue as soon as the legislative session begins next month. Wilson Sayre of Here and Now contributor WLRN in Miami has been exploring what that limbo has meant for people affected by the death penalty. Yesterday, we heard the story of one of the inmates on Florida's death row. Today, we meet two women who lost loved ones to violent crime and who hold very different views on capital punishment.
It took almost 30 years from when her sister's murderer was convicted for Deborah Knights to find herself in the execution chamber watching him slowly die. She sat in the front row with her brother, Sal Cox, who cried throughout the 11 minutes it took to declare Robert Henry dead. I was in the back row, but I could still see him constantly wiping his eyes. His sister, Deborah, rubbed his back. Afterwards, across the street from the prison, she read a statement while her brother, Sal, was still crying.
We, the family of Janet Cox Thermidor, will always cherish the memory of her life. Janet was a devoted daughter, sister, aunt, niece, cousin, and a friend to many. We will always cherish the memory of her life that was taken so soon by a demon from hell. Today should be closure, but how can you forget the brutal way in which two lives were taken without remorse? Our family will never be able to experience what life would have or could have been like had Janet been here. It's our prayer as a family that one day we will be able to forgive, but we will never forget.
Deborah, her mom, her sister, and her brother, they went up and stayed the night not far from the prison. Only Deborah and her brother actually went to the execution.
I wanted him to get the electric chair. That's what I wanted to see. I wanted him to suffer. He didn't suffer. I mean, you know, they stuck a needle in there and he went to sleep, basically.
Deborah was the one who had to go to the coroner's office and identify her sister. Janet had been burned so badly she was almost unrecognizable. And that image and the thoughts of Janet's last moments are part of Deborah now. Deborah says if there wasn't a recording of Janet saying Henry's name before she died, maybe she would have reservations about the death penalty. Hearing her sister's voice, that was 100% confirmation that this was the man who murdered Janet.
When you take somebody's life, I mean, why should you have your life? You've taken something that you can't give back. Just to take somebody's life, just to do it because you can do it, yeah, your life should be taken. I always believe that and still do.
But what didn't feel like justice to her and her family was how long it took for the sentence to be carried out. That was 30 years Henry's family had the opportunity to visit, talk, and hug him.
He was still breathing. We would have to go to a graveyard and look at a tombstone to visit my sister.
During those 3 decades, her family went to all the appeals, hearings, and trials that came after Robert Henry's initial sentence. Former Florida Supreme Court Justice Charlie Wells believed these kinds of cases just took too long, and he tried to do something about that.
I would remark on several occasions that the case would be going on so long that the only person that was still alive would be the person on death row. Every case went through the system at least twice, and usually 3 or 4 or 5 times.
He says during that time, lawyers for the state, defense lawyers, and judges would change.
There would be instances in which cases were just sitting in the circuit court for 6, 7, 8 years with no attention at all.
He tried a lot of different things to unstick cases. He started a class that judges who tried capital cases were required to take. He streamlined the process for the paperwork going through the Florida Supreme Court. But these cases still don't move much faster than they did back then. Part of this is there's so many things an inmate can challenge. The drugs used in lethal injection, whether their lawyers did their jobs correctly, new evidence that could be looked at. 2 years after Robert Henry's execution, a photo of Janet hangs by Deborah's front door.
Oh my God, this is the old one. I don't even think of it.
The old photograph has fallen down in its frame. It's yellowed and part of the image has peeled off. It's a formal portrait. Janet sitting sideways with her head held high and a big smile on her face.
So when was this photo?
I think this is not long before her death.
And Deborah, she can look at this picture and not get upset. She says the execution almost 3 years ago gave her that freedom.
You know, it's finished. It's done. I don't have to worry about him coming back for appeals. You know, I don't want to have to hear about them, you know, in articles about him and whatnot. It's over. I've had the closure that I needed, you know. And, you know, you get little memories, but then you can laugh, you can smile about it. Say, oh, look at Janet, this and that. But at one time, you couldn't do that.
Despite the 30 years it took, Deborah Knights would still rather have this flawed system than nothing at all. But that's not true for everyone.
Name one good thing that comes out of somebody getting executed. To me, it makes more victims.
Darlene Farah is at the very start of the process Deborah Knights and her family are beginning to put behind them. Darlene's 20-year-old daughter, Shelby, was killed while working at a Metro PCS store. This happened in July of 2013 in Jacksonville, Florida. Shelby's killer was caught and has confessed to the killing. And almost from the start, Darlene has been fighting against the death penalty for her daughter's killer.
I've always raised my kids, two wrongs don't make a right. And Shelby and I have had many discussions about it.
And she was against the death penalty?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was something we always said.
I mean, you're often, people in your position are often the argument. People say it's for the victims' families.
They don't know what the victim's family goes through.
She says other families who've had relatives murdered have gotten in touch, saying they support her push to prevent the death penalty in her daughter's case. She's heard from people who didn't realize that death penalty trials are often longer than non-death penalty trials. There are more appeals. It takes years or decades for it all to be over, like in Deborah Knight's case. Darlene just wants to be done with it. In Jacksonville, the case has been in the press constantly, and that's been hard on Darlene and her family. She says she wants the prosecution to accept a plea deal the defense has offered up. 2 life sentences plus 20 years. No parole, no appeals.
Every time we have a court date, I start shutting down. My son, we all grieve differently. So it's like we're all trying to prepare ourselves and psych ourselves up. I know I don't want him to get the death penalty, but it takes everything out of me when I look at him. I don't feel sorry for him because he was 21 when he did it. It was premeditated. He knew what he was doing.
Over the past year, Darlene's daughter's case has gone pretty much nowhere. Because of the various legal challenges that threw Florida's death penalty into limbo, the state hasn't been able to move cases forward. Despite all of this, Darlene Farah is glad it's getting harder for people to be sentenced to death in Florida. She's become a sort of activist against the death penalty. She's spoken to legislators and nonprofit groups and says she'll keep doing that even after her daughter's case is resolved.
My job will not be done till the changes are made.
For Darlene, closure isn't going to be exacted by the courts. That will come between her and her daughter Shelby's killer.
He wants to talk to me, and I wanted to talk to him. Which that right there alone will bring me a little bit of closure.
The lawyers don't think it's a good idea before the trial. Both sides still have a case to mount, and death is still on the table.
I want him to know about the person's life he took away. I want him to know that if we knew him before this happened, what Shelby would have been wanting to do.
For now, Darlene is waiting. New sentencing rules have been introduced in the Florida House and Senate. Some defense lawyers, though, are worried the bills don't do enough to deal with outstanding problems with the death penalty. Questions about the list of things that can send you to the execution chamber and what should happen to the people who've already been sentenced to death continue to plague the state's death penalty. Farah will be going to the Capitol and asking the legislature to abolish the death penalty altogether. But in Florida, that's unlikely to happen. For Here and Now, I'm Wilson Sayre in Miami.
We're expecting President Trump to issue a new travel ban this week after the first one, which included a ban on Syrian refugees, was halted by the courts. The United States has taken in about 18,000 Syrian refugees since 2011, out of 11 million who have been displaced by the fighting. Syria's closest neighbors, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan, have taken in millions. But what about wealthy Arab countries in the region like Saudi Arabia and the UAE? Kathleen Newland is a senior fellow and the co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And why haven't these wealthy countries like Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates taken in more refugees from Syria?
Well, it's a little deceptive when you look at the published figures because none of the Gulf Arab states are actually signatories to the UN Refugee Convention, and they don't have a legal status inside the country called refugee. But the fact is that they actually have a lot of Syrians. According to the UN Refugee Agency, there are 500,000 Syrian refugees in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis say there have been, if you count all the churning, as many as 2.5 million. But even if you go with the UN Refugee Agency figure, 500,000 Syrians is a lot for a country of about 30 million.
They're just not considered refugees.
They are not. They don't have the legal status of refugees, which carries a certain amount of vulnerability because they're there as businessmen, they're there as students, as tourists. But they don't have the security of refugee status, which means that they basically can't be sent home as long as conditions remain dangerous in their home country. And the situation in Saudi Arabia is true in most of the Gulf states.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that they've got a lot of Syrians living in their countries that are not considered refugees, but they're doing an adequate amount. Is that fair? Or do you think that these countries could be doing more in terms of bringing more refugees in?
Well, it would be nice if the people who were there had a more secure status. Although in Kuwait, for example, which has about 120,000 Syrians, these are mainly people who went to Kuwait on a visa and overstayed their visas. But the Kuwaitis have not deported them. In fact, they've granted many of them long-term residency permits, people who came as visitors or
people who came as visitors since the war started in Syria or before that?
Before that and during. Kuwait has an enormous number of workers on temporary contracts. I'm sure there were some Syrians among them as well. Similarly, Saudi Arabia has given permanent residence to, they say, hundreds of thousands of Syrians, and there are over 100,000 Syrian students in Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, there is much to criticize in the situation, but it's just not correct to say that they have not taken in any Syrians.
But why do you think that countries like Lebanon and Jordan have taken in so many more than these Gulf states?
Because they're next door.
Just because they're next door.
Absolutely. That is overwhelmingly the case all over the world when you have refugee situations.
When you look at the countries around the world and the refugees they've been taking in from Syria, who's the model country and who's the opposite of that?
Well, I guess in a way you could identify Turkey as a model country in this respect. It's kind of hard to find nice things to say about Turkey these days, but they have been extremely generous to the Syrian refugees. Turkey has, you know, allows Syrian refugees to use their health services, to use their educational system, and has set up refugee camps for about 10% of the Syrian population there. So the Turks have been very generous. I guess the opposite of that would be some of the Balkan states and East European, even East European members of the European Union who have said they absolutely will not take refugees from other European countries, and have erected fences on their borders so that refugees can't pass through. So they've been extremely unwelcoming.
Do you think that after this terrible experience with what's happened in Syria and all of the people who have been displaced as a result of it and all of the places they've been able to go and not go, that it's time for a new refugee convention, that it's time for a new global treaty that says when a war happens and people are displaced, we all have a responsibility to take some of them in?
That would certainly be highly desirable. And last September, September 19th, there was an unprecedented high-level summit, I mean head of state-level summit at the United Nations, which agreed to the member states agreed to negotiate a global compact on refugees by 2018. But I am not very optimistic that it will result in any binding commitments.
That's Kathleen Newland, who's a senior fellow and co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.